Well, this morning we've come together here to talk a little bit about marriage, something about what's going on in the marital scene today, and then more significantly, what is the essence of the marital relationship. And this is what I'll try and get at in some material I give you, and then we'll pick up on a discussion and take it as far as we want to. Currently today in America, there are about 200 or 2 million marriages each year. There are about 500,000 divorces. There are approximately 2 million people who are separated, not living together, but not legally separated, still legally bound together. And Bossert and Ball, the sociologists, have indicated that somewhere between one-third and one-half of the American people who are married are experiencing some kind of stress. There's something in the relationship that keeps them from labeling themselves as entirely happy or extremely happy, but when they're asked to do some checking, they have a tendency to check lower down on the scale of marital happiness. We are also living in a time when throughout the world and in America, there are different experiments going on as to the types of marriage. We hear of communal marriages. We hear of people who believe you should live together until you are ready to be married. Margaret Mead recently came out with what she called a two-step marriage. The first marital relationship, or the first relationship between the two people, is primarily for fun and exploration of oneself, for growing up, so to speak. And the second go-around, which may well be with a different person, is for the purpose of procreation. These things, which a very few years ago, were looked upon as really avant-garde, are now being discussed somewhat seriously by a number of people. The communes of the California coast, and I guess up in this area too, are getting a play in the newspapers. In the Scandinavian countries, in Germany, you find a lot of this. When I was in Europe a year ago or 2 years ago, there were many, many couples who were simply traveling around Europe, and figures that these are not necessarily married couples, but they're just two young people who have attached themselves to one another and who believe that this is a legitimate way of expressing themselves. Now, what I'd like to do this morning is to approach this matter not critically, particularly, but with an investigative mind, seeing if we can determine, well, what is the essence then of the marital relationship? What is it that makes two people's relationship what we would call marriage, and not just a casual or a meaningful sexual relationship of some other kind? I'll begin by giving you some definitions of marriage, which come from a number of sources, some you may recognize. First one is, marriage is an institutionalized mating arrangement between human males and females. The second is, marriage is that order of creation given by God in love, which binds one man and one woman in a lifelong union of the most intimate fellowship of body and life. And here's the third one. Mating is a biological matter, while marriage is a social affair. Marriage implies a ceremony, a union with social sanctions, a recognition of obligations. And another, marriage is an institution which civilization imposed upon males, not females. And this one you may recognize. Marriage is a holy estate ordained of God and to be held in honor by all. Now, there's no limit to the definition of marriages. Sociologists give them, psychologists give them, theologians give them. And I'd like to give you another one, which is my own. Marriage is a relationship of commitment between two persons, male and female, who live together in a sexual union, in a mutually sustaining estate, or state intended to be permanent, and who assume together the pleasures and responsibilities which may be present or which may ensue, including the conception and the rearing of children. Now, within a marriage relationship, there are all kinds of factors which play in. There's the economic, the emotional, the religious, the social, the ethnic, and each of these contributes something to marriage and gives it a certain stamp. But the most significant factor of all, as I see it, is that of personal commitment, which is expressed in sexual love. And in this commitment, all of the ramifications can be found, which I think define and constitute the essence of marriage. Now, one should study marriage from the viewpoint of the anthropologist and from the social scientist and the psychologist, the theologian. I think it's necessary to look in our day at the hedonist, that is the one who's caught up with the concept of pleasure as the essence of life. And when we look at all of these, we end up with sort of a continuum. And on this continuum, we can either take our place or we can say, even if I go over here or come over to this position out of the 5 or 10 or 15 that there may be, I still see certain values in all of them. In other words, we're not talking about something is all right or all wrong, but we're saying in each of these various viewpoints of marriage, there is something of value. And so we become eclectic and we reach out and we draw the best that we can for our own understanding. Now, I'd like to give you 5 views this morning, or 5 positions that you can look at. The first is that marriage is a relationship which is based primarily on biological drives. And in parentheses, I would put the word survival. Secondly, marriage is shaped by social forces. And this is where society gets involved. Thirdly, marriage is modified because of personal concerns. And this is where the self is the dominant factor. Fourth, marriage is a relationship defined by unconditional commitment. This is where we serve one another, the element of service. And then fifth, marriage is established as a divine order of creation, and this is where you obviously have the sacred or the exclusively religious. Now, we begin with biological drives. And we say that marriage is rooted in the biological and the psychological makeup of man. This deals with the idea of racial survival. Why do we survive as a race? Simply because there are strong sex drives. Walter Stokes, a psychiatrist, in speaking about this, says that there is no better preparation for marriage or no sounder foundation upon which to build marriage than a strong sexual attraction. And he says that's true simply because man is a sexual animal. We don't have to quote Freud or to look at modern psychology. We simply have to look at man as he is constituted. And he said, when you look at man, you see that through the years, man has developed into an extremely sex-conscious individual. Of all creatures on earth, man is the most sexual. Man is the one creature that seemingly is not does not have his sexuality defined or controlled by cycles. We speak of the mating season as far as animals are concerned. This just is not true of humankind. The Dutchman Van de Velde wrote in his book Ideal Marriage these two sentences, which I think are rather interesting. He says, life is dominated by the urge of self-preservation and by the sexual urge. The former, that is self-preservation, preserves the individual, and the sexual urge preserves the race. For biological purposes, racial preservation is more urgent than individual survival, and therefore the urge of sex is stronger than hunger and stronger than fear. And then it's easy to see why lovers risk and sometimes lose life and limb in the pursuit of one another's love. And it explains also why people are drawn out of their retirement, why we have very few hermits, why people will overcome tremendous psychological barriers to communication and ultimately end up as married creatures. You say of someone, well, he's so shy, I don't see how he will ever get married. And yet later on in life you discover that, he did find a wife after all. Or you say, she is such a little mousy creature, or he is such a homely character. How are they going to find anybody? And yet they do. And it's a strong, biologically based sexual urge that brings people out of all kinds of what would be called hang-ups and security from behind their own security blankets and so forth, to risk, you see, encounter with another person, and this other person is a male or female of the opposite sex, and marriage ensues. We're familiar with the growth of children, psychological growth of children, and we recognize that at age 10 or 11 or 12, the average red-blooded American boy knows very well what he's going to be when he grows up. He's going to be an explorer, or he's going to be off in space someplace where there are no girls, where he's safe, you see, from attack by these voracious creatures who already are beginning to make his life miserable. And by the time he gets to be 13 or 14, he's got flowers in one hand and a candy in another, and he's trying somewhat clumsily to ring somebody's doorbell, and on the other side of the door there's a girl. His glands have caught up with him. He's trapped. There isn't anything he can do about it because he's a human being. Now, marriages take place then basically because of sexual needs. So this is the foundation. Sexual union is the sine, or sex in marriage, so sexual union is a sine qua non of marriage. It's possible to have too much sex in marriage, though usually this is not the case. It's possible to have too little sex in marriage, but you cannot eliminate it entirely and still speak of a marriage relationship. An ecclesiastical court and a civil court will both agree that if there has been no sexual consummation in what is purported to be a marriage, then this indeed was not a marriage. And so instead of going through the divorce mill or a divorce action illegally, you simply seek an annulment. And either of the two will allow for an annulment, because they say there is no marriage at this point. Now, sexual relationships in one form or another preceded what we call social marriage by a considerable distance in time. Men and women simply mated. And then after a while, man ceased merely to mate and he began to marry. LaPierre, an anthropologist, says simply marriage, the family, is based on a compromise. And it's sort of an arrangement. The male receives the sexual favors of the female. The child that is born receives the mother's breast and her care. And on this kind of a compromise and an arrangement, the family is born. It's impossible, really, to do more than speculate on the types of arrangements that may have been worked out at the beginning of, or in the early days of time. Group marriages, polygamy, polyandry, one wife, many husbands, one husband, many wives, and so forth. Although there are many people who don't really look upon these as a totally legitimate form of marriage, but rather as a form of cohabitation. But wherever it is, whatever their type of relationships, it has a sexual base. And so we start then with this. Then the second one is social forces, where society gets involved into this whole business of mating and marriage. And when primitive man left off mating and began to enter into a relationship, it was a higher stage of interaction. He became responsible for his actions. He was made responsible and held responsible for his sexual life. He made a contract with society. Instead of merely going flitting from flower to flower to flower, impregnating as many females as might give in to his advances, society says, look, you can't do this, or the group or the clan or whatever kind of an arrangement there was at the moment says, look, you can't do this, you can't get away with it, there isn't enough food to go around, and if you're going to bring children into this world, then you are going to be responsible for feeding those children. And so, in spite of himself, the aggressive male was led or was guided or was forced into a position where he simply had to take care of the offspring that he brought into the scene. One man has described it this way. He says, marriage is a ceremony whereby this ability to provide for the economic for an infant is certified, and whereby a man commits himself to economic and sexual cooperation with a given woman. And so, in spite of himself, he is then forced to provide, to be responsible as a man and as a male for his sexual desires. And it's at this point, you see, that the right of society, the rights of society, as it affects marriage, are seen. There is the drive of the individual, and there is the society, the group, which says, but wait, you cannot function as an individual and get away with it. We simply won't put up with this. And here is where the first right of a social group to control an individual is seen. And this right is still insisted upon today, in spite of the fact that a great many young people say, look, what we do is our own business, whether we marry or not is our own business. You simply leave us alone. And by and large, society is not yet willing to buy this, and probably will not. See, what has happened is that this has become now a moral problem. And it's a problem of responsibility. And so a man cannot do his own thing without someone else saying, but wait, you're impinging upon our rights. You have no right to do this because there is someone else here, and this individual has a right, or collectively, we have rights. George Bernard Shaw has written in Man and Superman in a very interesting and a humorous way about this. He has a couple of his characters in Man and Superman discussing marriage, and one of them says, look, the male was not made to marry, and to blame him for being sexually promiscuous or wanting to go from one person to another is just as foolish as to blame a bee for going from one flower to another in search of honey. But then someone else says, well, why then does man allow himself to get married, or why does man marry if this is counter to his nature? And he says, well, the reason he marries is because he's simply tricked into it. He doesn't do his own thing. Society imposes its will upon him. He said, look, what do men do? They allow themselves to be hung. This is a poor analogy to marriage, most of us would think. But he says, a man will allow himself to walk up the gallows and be hung without even a struggle. The least he could do, you know, is to give the chaplain a black eye. But he doesn't even do this. And he said, that's the way it is with man, with a male today. Women, mothers-in-law, potential mothers-in-law, society as a whole, simply leading up the gallows, and they trip the thing, and he is hung. He is married. Now, where is this found today, this social pressure? It's found in the presence of a witness. Whether a man is married in the Justice of the Peace office in Las Vegas, or in a marriage chapel, or he's married in his own hometown with a church and family around him, there is always the presence of a witness. Society is always represented. I have married literally hundreds of people through the years, but I have always asked, do you have the license now, or will you please give me your license? Because these people have had to go and to signify their intent to wed and to get permission from the state to to go through this particular kind of thing, because the state wants to be, the state is concerned and it wants to be present. And at the end of the ceremony, you always bring in the best man and one of the attendants, and you say, "Will you sign here as witnesses?" And then you send this back to the state. And if I don't go through this process in the state of California, I'm subject to a $500 fine. The state is that much interested in seeing that this kind of a thing is done right. And what happens is, you see, that through these procedures, formal, informal, whatever they may be, this is society's way of saying we recognize and we accept and we sanction the responsible vows which you have made to one another today and what you have made to the social group. And involved in this sanctioning, you see, is the implicit statement that we will support you in this. And this comes about in a number of ways. As far as the state is concerned, it's a contractual arrangement. As far as the individuals are concerned, it may be, and it should be, a commitment. But the state is interested in the contract, in the agreements which have been established. Now we move then into what we find in our society. One man has said that basically today, this is Harvey Locke and Burgess, that what we are finding is a movement away from marriage as an institution to marriage as companionship. And the focus today, we don't have to look very far to discover, is on what I feel, what I want to do. It's upon my individual rights. We speak of people being interested, the Constitution speaks of it being interested in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If you were to check out how a great many people feel today, they would say, yes, that's right. But it's my life I'm interested in, it's my liberty I'm concerned about, and it's my happiness that I'm pursuing in this whole business. And so a typical young American is concerned about his welfare and his self-fulfillment, but it is almost exclusively on his own and not those of another person. Now, in the past, there were a great many factors which unified the family and which held it together. There was public opinion, there was law, there were customs, there was the mores, there was tradition, there was the family, there was discipline, there was elaborate ritual, and all of these things, you see, sort of supported and organized and structured the marital relationship. But what happens today is that the emphasis is coming to be placed upon the individual, and the individual is concerned about mutual affection and understanding and almost having a soulmate, someone with whom I can live together. People today are displaying really a great deal of sense when you find them being more interested, when they approach marriage, in companionship and in personal qualities than in physical build and the romantic delusions of even a couple of decades ago. There's a great deal of common sense being displayed by young people as they approach marriage. I find them at college caught up in what is almost a fetish of talk. That they want to talk through everything. They want to understand. They want to probe. They want to clarify all points of difference. They've embarked really upon almost an impossible venture, the venture which is going to absorb them the rest of their lives. But at least they're starting on it, you know, with the hope, I think, that they can somehow get these things all squared away before they decide upon marriage per se. And they do this because of a desire for personal happiness. Personal happiness is the goal of today. Marriage is a very delicate relationship. It's subject to attack and pressure from so many different points. When you just look at that single factor which I gave you at the beginning, half a million marriages breaking up in America every day. You don't have to document much further than this the fact, you know, that certainly this is a an area that's under stress and difficulty. This question of divorce is one of the major factors. In 1950, there was a study completed on what factors have changed most in the American marital scene in the last 50 years, or the last 100 years. And they asked 18 experts to give their interpretations, and they gave a number of them. You know, the shift of education out of the home into the society, same thing with protection, the strengthening of the rights of women, the shift away from the authoritarian family and so forth. But there was not total agreement except at one point, and that was the facility with which divorce can be achieved and the attitudes which people have towards divorce even as they enter into marriage. Divorce is the most significant change that has taken place. Now, divorce, you see, is not a communal action. It's an individual action. Again, in many ways, it expresses the individual's desire to be happily married. Sometimes it can be based on pure selfishness. An individual says, you know, I want something, I'm not getting it, therefore we'll call this thing quits. On the other hand, it may be an individual who simply has such high ideals for marriage that he's not willing to settle for anything less. And so if there's unhappiness or there's bitterness or there's lack of understanding or communication, he says, this is not what marriage is all about. And consequently, we've got to do something about it, or I've got to do something about it. And people will break up their marriages and move on into another one, which may be more or less successful, simply because they won't settle for anything less than the best in marriage. Landis says it's doubtful that humanity has ever sought a goal in marriage so difficult to realize and yet so worthy of attainment as happiness. And he's not talking about happiness now in the shallow, we must always be smiling bit, but this business of a basic satisfaction which can come in the middle of life. And he says this is the highest good which a great many people are choosing as they enter into their adult life, and they simply won't settle for anything less than the best. Then you have the fourth element in marriage, which is unconditional commitment. Karl Barth said in one of his writings, he who enters in upon marriage renounces the possibility of ever leaving. You see, Barth says that the man who enters marriage is moving into an irrevocable state. He cannot go back on this. It's not a contract that has terms. Marriage, from a theological point of view, is not a contract with escape clauses built in, with certain stipulations. It is a commitment between two persons, and it goes well beyond the contract. There may be some contractual elements in it, but it goes way beyond this. For instance, let's look just at the marriage, the words in the marriage service as we find them in most of our hymnals and as we know them. It almost seems as if the people who put this marriage service together are looking down the pike and they're saying, wait a minute before you go into this, let's take a look and see what's really going to happen. And then they begin to point and they say, you love this person. Will you love them in case of poverty or riches, you know, wealth? How does the phrase go? For richer, for poorer, for better, for worse. You know, your condition may go downhill, in sickness and in health. Are you sure you will be willing to still be committed to this individual, if there are physical problems that ensue. How long is this commitment to be for? So long until death do us part. Who's involved in this commitment? How many people are you going to love? Forsaking all others, keep thee only unto her. So you see, there's a narrowing, there's a focusing, and there is an intent to make people face the implications of this decision before they really commit themselves to the decision. And this it's this element of commitment, you see, irrevocable, unconditional commitment that really gives marriage its depth as far as the church is concerned. Elton Trueblood said on one occasion, commitment is the crucial step in religious experience. When one is committed to Christ, this is a religious commitment. When one makes a commitment in marriage, this is also a religious commitment. That's why a marriage before a justice of the peace in the presence of a waitress or the JP's wife brought in from the back room is nevertheless a religious commitment. It is a religious ceremony. It is as binding as one done before an altar with priest and pastor and incense and witnesses and organ and all the rest, as long as it is a commitment between two persons. It is just as religious a ceremony. And when people pledge themselves to one another in love until life's end, this is, according to a Christian point of view, this is a binding which God is doing. Whom God hath joined together, let not man put asunder, we say at someplace in the wedding service near the end of it. And while the justice of the peace may not speak these words, nevertheless, implicitly, this has happened. God has joined two people together, even if they are not conscious of the fact, even if they have no interest in religion per se, even if they are not particularly even aware of the depth of or the extent of the commitments here or the concomitants that go with it, as long as it is a commitment of love between two persons. Now, unconditional commitment can add a new dimension to life, to married life. Almost without exception, marriages are going to enter into periods of stress and difficulty. Through the years, there is attrition that takes place. We're not physically as beautiful or as attractive or as strong or as whole as the years go on as we were at the time of our marriage. Our health can be taken from us. Beauty can disappear. Fortune can change. Passion can be lessened. All these can be diminished or sometimes even lost. And these, you see, are the accoutrements of marriage. And sometimes the storms and stresses of life can simply strip these away. And there are moments in some marriages, at least, in many, I would suspect, when the only thing that holds people together is the fact that they are committed to one another. And this commitment, you see, holds individuals steady on a path which they have agreed upon ahead of time, and it carries them along in this direction until through counseling and friendship and time and opportunity, the relationship can be restored to its original strength. And people can see that we do have one another. We do belong to one another. I used the illustration the other night in the Vespers meditation, saying that C.P. Wren described once a march in the French Foreign Legion. He writes, Beaujas, Beausebour, and others of this kind. But he described this soldier's experience. And the soldier said, we had to march 50 miles that day through the sand. And they said, pretty soon your legs begin to ache, then your head begins to ache because of the sun, and then your back begins to ache because of the pack upon it, And pretty soon he said, you can't distinguish where the aches and the pains come from. Your body is just one mass of pain. But he said, you continue going on. Why? Because you have made a decision to go there, because you have willed to arrive. And so you do. And there are times in life, you see, when the only thing that will pull us through is simply the will that we have made. Alfred Kinsey, in his book on the sexual behavior in the human male, wrote these, or reported his conclusions in this way. He said, a preliminary examination of 6,000 marital histories in the present study and of nearly 3,000 divorce histories suggests that there may be nothing more important in a marriage than a determination that it shall persist. In short, the will to be one, the will to remain together, the will to exclude all others and keep the only one to her or him as long as you both shall will, this is at the very heart of the marriage decision. And then to continue with Kinsey, he says, with such determination, individuals force themselves to adjust and to accept situations which would seem sufficient grounds for a breakup if a continuation of the marriage were not the prime objective. When I talked to the kids the other night, I said, you know, marriage adjustment is not deciding or is not the conflict between squeezing the toothpaste tube in the middle or rolling it up neatly at the end. I'm a roller, my wife is a squeezer. On occasion, we have some banter about this. I said, marriage conflict comes when there is something you want to do, something you feel is right, something that is good for you, and your partner has a different point of view, and it is also right for them in terms of their psychological makeup and their experience and so forth, and on the fact that they come from this background and bring maybe 20, 25 years of marriage or of pre-marriage life to this relationship, and you do the same, and you have a conflict. Well, what do? You work it out. You work it out with compromise. You work it out with love. You work it out with loud words. You work it out in many different ways. But you work it out, you see, if you are married, if you are committed to one another. And it's this business of the commitment, you see, that makes the difference. I would imagine that in any city, 1,000 times, 10,000 times a day, the question comes up, you know, am I really married to the right person? And if a person was married in the church, he asks the question, you know, really, how could God have anything to do with my being married to such an ununderstanding mate? Did God really have anything to do with her, or was it merely a physical desire? Was it infatuation? Was it that meddling mother-in-law of mine who trapped me into this situation? Maybe the fact that we're now caught in this distress, this difficulty, indicates that basically God had nothing to do with it. How could God bring together two people and then leave them in the kind of a mess and an unhappy situation in which we find ourselves? Maybe God really wants me to marry or would like to see me related to this other person who has now appeared upon the scene and who is so warm and so understanding and so sympathetic and so forth. Maybe I was wrong in the first place. Am I really bound to live out my mistake for the rest of my life with this individual, the consequences of a poor choice? Well, I think there are two considerations that you have to look at briefly. One is, it's conceivable that any married person could have married someone else. You know, what if you'd taken a different job? What if your car hadn't broken down at a certain place and you went in and met this person? What if this, what if that? What if you if your parents hadn't moved? This kind of thing. I don't think it makes any sense to say marriages are made in heaven ahead of time. Marriages are made really on earth. But they're made in very specific ways. My marriage to another person, our pledged commitment to one another, our shared bed, makes this person the only person for me. We share a history. We revealed ourselves, our souls to one another. We've gone through sometimes almost hell on earth. We've spent sleepless nights worrying about others. We have reproduced ourselves and our children. And all of these things, you see, have made us a part of one another. And your being made for me is not something that is there ahead of time, but it's something that is created out of the personal sharing of life. And two people who make commitments to one another actually become irreplaceable to one another. So that a man can say, in spite of my doubts, our problems of the moment, there is only one hope of marital happiness as far as I'm concerned, and that's in my life with this woman. And she says, my life with this man. There is only one man. My hope of happiness rests with this one man. There is only one direction to go. There is only one person with whom I can solve this problem. Therefore, we will work this out. You know, come hell or high water, we will work this out because we are a couple. We are married. The alternative is to hold things in abeyance. The alternative is never to make a commitment. The alternative is to keep evaluating the marriage relationship with the question in mind, should it continue to exist? Is it proper? Is it right? And it's to analyze your spouse and yourself and a third person comes along and to contrast them and to do this endlessly. At this point, I'm drawing on some of the insights of Helmut Thielicke, and he says simply, look, God does not give you another individual to serve a function in your life, a sexual partner, a good housekeeper, a splendid provider, an economic genius. God gave you another person. If you marry a function, then as soon as you can find someone who can do the function better, the obvious thing to do is to make a shift, to make an exchange. But he said, rather, God has given us a person, and he has given me the privilege and the responsibility of helping to create something beautiful in the life of this other person. And then he said something that is worth remembering. He paraphrased Adam's words to Eve. She is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. And he said, she is boredom because of my boredom, and she is loveless because of my lack of love. What I do to my spouse creates the kind of an individual that person is. It's so easy, you see, in terms of marital stress, when there is no commitment, to look for the way out. And this means all of the energies and the concern and the interest and the memories and the affection which could have gone towards not only healing the breach but building even a stronger relationship, these get diffused out as one begins to play the field again long after he had moved into a marriage. A marriage of commitment, you see, is a relationship between two free people. Perhaps God has made us free in this area so that we can bind ourselves irrevocably, because only a decision made out of freedom is a decision which is really the most binding of all. Now, there are those within the Judeo-Christian tradition, as they look at marriage, who feel that it is more than even this. It's more than that which man does. It is something that is of God's creative order. And they speak of the divine order of creation, and they say that's what marriage is. In fact, all human relationships are. And here you have to go to the writings of Karl Barth. Barth talks about labor, you know, and capital. He talks about parents and children. He talks about the state and the individual. And he talks a great deal about marriage, about the relationships between a man and a woman. And Barth believes that all basic relationships in life are part of the order of God's creation. And he says a man is not really going to be happy until he has discovered what is proper, what is right, or really, he's not going to be happy until he's discovered what this relationship is, and then involves himself in his marital relationship according to the pattern which God has laid out. The Greeks have a myth about marriage, and the myth is that man was at one time, generic man was at one time a sort of a bi creature, male, female, together, hermaphroditic. And somehow he got broken into two parts, and now male, female creatures are half creatures. And they go through life seeking to find the other half. And when they have found the other half, then they become whole creatures once more. Now, myths of this kind, you see, are not fairy stories. They are stories which get down to the essence of things and which describe how people, how a race views the real depth, the meanings of things. We find the same thing almost expressed in the first chapters of Genesis. What does this say? You have Adam, which means man, generic man, and he exists. And then he is divided into his two component parts, male and female, the man and the woman. And then, Joe, almost as an aside, when does this happen? It happens when in sleep. That is, man was not there when God did this. God is the only one who understands how man and woman can live separately and how they can live together. It is God who performs the surgery here and separates man, this Adam, into the component parts. And so then man wakes up and he says he's drawn to this woman. The male is drawn to this woman, and he says, this now, you know, he's looked over the animal kingdom, and he says, here's someone who is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. And yet, one of the insights is, you see, that this thing took place when man was asleep. We do not understand one another. Theodore Reich says that the difference between man and woman is so great that you would really think that they were two different species, and not just male and female of the same species. And I think it would help us as husbands and wives if we could understand this, that this woman we live with is not a man. I remember one time when I was engaged in a very logical, cool, calm, and collected argument with my wife. And I was laying out all the evidence at hand, you know? And finally she said in some disgust, you're simply trying to make me think like a man. And I was. So you know, I knew I had lost at that point. So I gave up the argument. I was trying to be logical. Out of my own masculine inclination. And she was feeling the problem. I was arguing the problem. And there was no possibility of our really getting together as long as we each held to our own position. Now, this idea of the two coming back together again really seems to have caught the imagination of the biblical writers. There's a technical word, henosis, one flesh. Adam knew his wife, sexual union. And from that time on, they are one flesh. And what God has put together in this way, in this physiological, personal union, let not man put asunder. And the Apostle Paul calls this a great mystery, and he makes it akin to the union between Christ and the church. But in Paul's mind, the nature of marriage is caught up and defined in this idea of one flesh. He says marriage is a contract, but it's more than a contract. Marriage is a commitment, but it's more than a commitment. Marriage is something that the people who are within it don't even understand. It's something that goes down to the ontological roots, what the Germans call the Urgrund of life, the very essence of a relationship. And it's beyond understanding, it's beyond explication, but it's there. And it's something which, in essence, only God could create. And if you begin to accept the scriptural position on marriage, you say it is a union which we cannot understand totally, but which did not exist and now exists, and has been brought about by two things. One is commitment, and the other is sexual consummation. A man's marriage comes into existence by this free choice of him as a free spirit. And something is started, something began, which just didn't exist before. Now, in this kind of thinking, you see, there is a profound respect for the right of an individual to be an individual and to make personal decisions. If man is a biological creature, an animal, basically, he will mate, and that's about all that's involved. If he's a social creature, He will work within society, and he will be subject to the laws which society imposes. If he is a rebel or an individualist, he will strike out after his own self-fulfillment, and he will say this is the most important part of life. But if he's wholly a person and he looks at other people as a person, I think he will relate himself to other people in the most responsible commitment of which he's capable. And in and through this relationship, he will find his own idea, his own identity, and at least the opportunity is there. Now I'm not sure whether it's tomorrow or Saturday, I'm going to be leading another group like this in the meaning of sexuality. And trying to get down again to the essence of what is the essence of the sexual act. What does this communicate? What does it establish? How is it involved in what we call this thing marriage? But I'd like to just sort of capstone what I've said this morning by giving you, again, the words of Barth. To enter in upon marriage is to renounce the possibility of leaving it. To enter in upon marriage is to renounce the possibility of leaving it. Now, if this kind of a philosophical base, theological understanding of marriage were prevalent, and this is the purpose of my writing and my talking about this and my counseling, then I think we would see some different styles of life developing, and we would see some of the better things of marriage as we see it now retained, and I think we would see also some very new and exciting things come about as people begin to form their marriages. Marriage is not something that's formed ahead of time, no matter how many books we read. Marriage is formed out of the raw material of two personalities. And since you don't have access to that raw material until you're married, you can't really do much with your marriage or with a marriage before you have committed yourself to it and entered in upon it. Okay, I've spoken probably too long this morning, but is there anything that you could toss into the hopper or into the fireplace and maybe we can burn it up?
What do you think the future of this new culture
Well, economically, it makes some sense. People, I look at my tool chests and all this kind of thing. You go into people's garages, and everybody duplicates what the guy next to him has right down the block. Everyone has a lawnmower. Everyone has an edge cutter. Everybody has a pair of shears and so forth, and it's incredible. The interesting thing that has come out, though, is that in the area of sharing, the one thing that is not a shareable commodity is the sexual experience. This still is a unique and an exclusive relationship. Now, this isn't true of kids who are simply shacking up on the beach or in Big Sur in Northern California, where it's just a sexual binge. But when people began to really ask, you know, what is the essence of our relationship, I think people can live together. Communally, people do, you know, in other cultures too. But I think the sexual... I don't see how this can take place without damage to the psyche of the individual, because I don't think that's what marriage is intended to be. When I said it's a sexual union intended to be permanent, this is my understanding of the essence of marriage. So while you see these things happening, I think we have to be careful lest we get caught up in the statistic race again. You know, major crimes went up 10% last year. Is this therefore the thing that we ought to do? There are so many people who are entering into non-legal sexual liaisons, and there are more than last year. So many percentage of the college population and so forth. Is this really a selling point? I think you have to go back and try to explore what is the essence of the sexual relationship and the marital relationship before an individual can make sound decisions at this point. I think people will do many of these things, but out of a search in some cases for more meaning than they see in the contemporary serial marriages, if extramarital sex is a pretty strong factor in American marriages, I don't, you know, they can't really get too upset then when they say, well, we're sleeping together too. If they're exchanging couples on the block, don't point any fingers at us. And there is some strength in there. There's some hurt and sting in that accusation. That marriage can offer something that cannot be found in other ways, yes. It doesn't mean that every person has to have sexual experience either. All we have to do is look at the many people who, by choice, have remained celibate, the contributions which they make to life. Dr. Phoenix, from Columbia, indicates in one of his books on education that some of the greatest contributions to culture, to understanding of humanity, have been made by people who deliberately chose to abstain from marriage and who invested their lives, their affections, their love in to other people and not focused it in within the marital relationship on one person. Yet I also think that marital love, sexual love, if it's satisfying, can be like rivers of living waters. It can keep the springs of love within people's personalities very much alive and very much very open and flowing. People in marriage who are not happy sexually are just not going to have enough love to go around. Their children are usually going to feel this, probably some of the first persons to feel it. But a sexually satisfied woman, for instance, has enough love for herself and for her children as well, and for the community in the neighborhood. Thank you for this morning.